Hi, everyone. This is Jillian with Court Junkie. Court Junkie is a true crime podcast that covers court cases and criminal trials using audio clips and interviews with people close to the cases. Court Junkie is available on Apple Podcasts and podcastone.com.
Do you like listening to stories about serial killers, unsolved mysteries? How about a cult or two? And what about those lesser known serial killers? Or how about the legend of a cryptid that will surely keep you up at night? And I know you'll love a good conspiracy theory, because who doesn't? Join me, Kayla, as my co-host Lexi and I tell you stories that will keep you coming back for more on our show, A Little Wicked. You can find A Little Wicked on Spotify, Apple, and anywhere else you can find podcasts. Check out our website, alittlewickedpodcast.webador.com, and our Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram, all under, you guessed it, A Little Wicked. We can't wait to tell you our stories.
I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors. Today on The Prosecutors, we continue our look at the murder of JonBenet Ramsey. Hello, everybody, and welcome to this episode of The Prosecutors. I'm Brett, and I'm joined, as always, by my stately co-host, Alice.
Thank you, Brett, for not calling me a small foreign faction.
Alice?
Or a small state.
you're a nation state.
I'm a nation state of my own, and I not only represent them, I am them.
You are them. Exactly.
If you guys are just hopping in now, you have no idea what we're talking about. And with that, you should probably
If you're just hopping in now, you really
I was going to say, maybe you should listen to the last 100 episodes of JonBenet and come back.
and then come back when you've caught up in a year. You can let us know what you think. But yeah, I mean, you know, we are back with more JonBenet Ramsey. Not going to waste a lot of time with chit-chat today, because we are on the fifth episode of this case, and I'm sure some of you are loving this and some of you are sick to death of it, so we're going to try and move on through. Obviously, we spent all of last week on the ransom note, which I think is 100% proper to do. I think, frankly, you could just talk about the ransom note when talking about this case, because it is the one piece of evidence that definitively is tied to the murderer, whoever they are. But we're going to move on from that to some of the other things in this case, some of the other evidence, and some of the other interesting and strange things that we see when we look at the murder of JonBenet Ramsey.
This is a big, big kind of red mark on the entire case, and we know that's the compromised crime scene. You can't talk about this case without the compromised crime scene, because if it weren't for such a compromised crime scene, we might have more answers. Now, as everyone knows and as we've spoken about time and again, protecting the crime scene is of critical importance. The more people who go through a crime scene, including police officers, the more likely the scene will be compromised in some way. That's just common sense. The theory of transfer says that anyone who enters a room either takes something with them or leaves something behind. If the scene is controlled, if access is limited to those who need to be there, if that access is recorded so that anything left by officers can be excluded, this is not a problem because you can account for what's taken or what's left. But there may have never been a more fundamentally compromised crime scene than in this case. Bizarrely, the officers who initially responded to the house only treated JonBenet's room as the crime scene. I mean, this is bizarre because as if the kidnapper had simply teleported in and out of her room when he kidnapped her. Because of this kind of step of only securing her room, the police did not stop the many friends who showed up from entering the Ramsey house. They did not stop them and the Ramseys from wandering all over the house. And in fact, it was at the behest of the police that John found the body of JonBenet. And then, of course, there's the victim advocates who, oh my goodness, came into the house, parked themselves in the kitchen, made food, and then cleaning up so much evidence that could have been there.
And I think it's so important to talk about the crime scene and how it's compromised before we get into the rest of this, because people will talk about the Ramsey case and the evidence in the case as if it is definitive. So you will read people on the internet who will say things like, it couldn't have been a break-in because all the doors were locked. And then you'll have people who say, well, it could have been a break-in because there was a door that was open. Or you'll hear people say, it couldn't have been a break-in because there was nothing disturbed around the window. And then other people say, actually, there were things that were disturbed. We're going to talk about all that. But the problem with it, you know, from the pineapple on down, is because of what was going on in that house that morning, I don't know how you can say with certainty anything. I don't know how you can be so sure about any particular fact in the case. And that's why you've heard us say so many times that one of two things is true about so much of the evidence, because we just don't know. We don't have as concrete an idea in this case about really anything. And we've talked about cases before where there's been obvious problems with how the police have interacted with the scene. So you might think of the Michael Peterson case, and there are a lot of people who think Michael Peterson is clearly guilty, and they'll point to the blood evidence, and there is strong blood evidence against him. The problem that we always point out is that because the expert who looked at that was so inept, and because the police did not properly record some of the facts about the blood and whether the blood was dry, there are pictures that clearly show blood in one picture and not another. Because of that, you really lose a lot of that, the strength of that evidence, and you have to rely on other things to really determine whether or not Michael Peterson was responsible. And you'll see that in a lot of cases where there'll be one piece of evidence that really feels compromised by something that someone did, and it's so frustrating. Because you always feel like, man, if we just had that one piece, maybe we'd know. The problem with this case is there's basically nothing that's not compromised. Everything's compromised. So, you know, when we talk about they found a fiber here or they found a fiber there, well, who knows where that fiber came from? Who knows who tracked it in or out or who left it? So that's a problem we're going to see again and again. We're going to try and work through it as best we can. But it's just important to know as we talk about this evidence that this is a critical problem we just can't get past. Alice, before we continue, I want to talk about one of our favorite sponsors, NordVPN. We know better than most how important your privacy is, particularly on the internet. You are doing more and more stuff online. You're paying your bills. You're doing all your shopping. You're doing things for your kids and for your family. And the last thing you want is someone you don't know watching what you do. You can avoid that with NordVPN. It's not just a VPN. It is a total cybersecurity package, and it can help keep you safe, secure, and private online. And the best thing, NordVPN is about to celebrate its 10-year birthday here in February, and they want to give you a gift along with a huge discount and 1 month for free. So grab your exclusive NordVPN deal by going to nordvpn.com/theprosecutors or use the code theprosecutors to get a huge discount off your NordVPN plan plus one additional month for free and a bonus gift. It's completely risk-free with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. That's nordvpn.com/theprosecutors or use the code theprosecutors to take advantage of this amazing offer and keep yourself safe online. So let's talk about the pineapple. We talked about the bowl of pineapple earlier, and pineapple is very important in this case. And JonBenet had what appears to be pineapple in her intestine. Based on its location and the rate of digestion, she likely ate it 1.5 to 2 hours before she died. Now, that time frame is speculative at best. There's no hard science on this. That's a good estimate. It's pretty clear she didn't eat it right before she died, for instance, and she didn't eat it the day before she died. But is it possible she ate it at the party that they were at earlier? Is it possible she ate it before they went to the party? There are reasons to think she might have or might not have, but just know that that 1.5 hour to 2 hour time frame is not perfect. Plus, we don't actually know when JonBenet died, so that also makes it difficult to determine exactly when she ate the pineapple. But in any event, you can budget at least probably 1 hour, 2 hours, up to maybe 3 or 4 even. But the best guess we have from the professionals is 1.5 to 2 hours. Her parents claim that she did not eat pineapple that night, and that she was asleep when they arrived home after the party and went straight to bed. So, according to her parents, she never ate pineapple. She couldn't have eaten pineapple before she went to bed because she was asleep when she got there. So, if she ate pineapple, then it must have been given to her by whoever killed her. This is sort of one of the assumptions.
I find this really interesting because I have taken, you know, it was the holidays and we went and visited family and we're at different kind of, I guess you could call them parties, more than just my immediate family. And my kids were there and my kids were younger than JonBenet was. And I generally know what they eat because they're still very young. I have to make sure they don't put, for example, foreign objects in their mouth because they're still at the age where they could choke. But I can't tell you definitively what they ate when we go to, especially if we go to a party, if they had pineapple, like normal kinds of foods. And so I know there could be claims of what was at the party or not, but even if food is not placed out, my kids somehow always find like the kids' snack bar, you know, so even if pineapple is not out, they may actually quite, this happened tonight, in fact. My son went into, you know, the refrigerator and pulled out a bag of blackberries and was like, I want blackberries. And they often do that at other people's homes because my children somehow just treat other people's homes like their own. So I just think it's very interesting that they're definitive that she could not have eaten it on their watch and maybe not their immediate watch.
I think this is a weird thing to be definitive about for the very reasons you talk about. Now, it's one thing to say we didn't give her any pineapple, but everybody is so adamant about this, as we're going to see as we talk about this a little bit more. But I think you're right, and I want to come back to what you're saying because I actually think you put your finger on it about what happened here. But what we know for sure is she's got pineapple in her intestine. And we know there's this bowl of pineapple found in the kitchen, that and it's in milk. Now, I have read that this was something Burke liked, pineapple in milk. I guess it's kind of like strawberries and cream type thing. I've never tried it personally, but I mean, it kind of sounds like it might be good. But in any event, there was this bowl. There was pineapple in the kitchen. It's in milk. The bowl had Patsy and Burke's fingerprints on it. Patsy says she didn't make it. But, you know, to me, the fact that a bowl in the kitchen has the fingerprints of somebody on it tells me nothing at all. You know, this bowl is their bowl. Patsy probably washed it or got it out of the, you know, the dishwasher at some point. It's not surprising that her fingerprints would be on it. Burke liked to eat pineapple. It's not surprising that his fingerprints would be on it. And just because the bowl's been washed doesn't mean the fingerprints would all be gone. So to me, this is not that significant. Now, it is interesting that it's on the kitchen counter. Obviously, there was someone murdered the night before, so you might think it's somehow involved. People who think Burke did it, some people have speculated that what happened was Burke, you know, JonBenet wasn't asleep. They all got home. They made Burke some pineapple and milk. JonBenet ate a piece. Burke got mad. He grabbed the flashlight, bashed her in the head with it, because there's a flashlight in the kitchen as well, a heavy-duty maglite flashlight. Bashed her in the head with it. That causes head injury. And then the parents, in order to save Burke, murdered or finished the job, essentially took JonBenet down to the basement and garroted her until she was dead. We're going to talk about that theory more later, but just to lay it out for you so you see why this pineapple might be important, this is something that people have tried to tie into the crime. A preliminary problem with that is the fact that it seems like JonBenet ate this at least an hour and a half before she died. So the sort of she eats the pineapple, Burke reacts, bashes her in the head with a wound that would have killed her. It's unlikely she would have lived that long after that wound in any event, particularly if she's then strangled to death. And we know that the strangulation whether it happened first or whether it happened after she was hit in the head did happen while she was alive. So that timeline is rough. But in any event, this is something people point to. It's also possible that the pineapple and the milk was made by the intruder, that this was part of sort of luring John Bidet down into the kitchen. There's pineapple, there's milk. You like that. Have some pineapple. Once again, the time frame problem is still a problem. It's hard to believe that after the parents come home that this person would have lured John Bidet downstairs, fed her pineapple, and then hung around for an hour and a half to 2 hours with her just in the house with everyone else in the house asleep. Not impossible, but certainly seems a little strange. But here's something that I think kind of may solve this. Now, we know that the Whites, who that's the party they were at. They were at the Whites' house. The Whites say they did not serve pineapple the night before. So if John Bidet ate pineapple, it wasn't them that gave the pineapple to them. And, you know, the Boulder police have tried to run this down, and they don't think there was any pineapple there either, though I'm not exactly sure how you prove that. But we found out something interesting in one of Burke's defamation cases. We're going to put those documents on the website if you haven't already looked at them. It is not the case that it was only pineapple in John Bonet's stomach. It appears that actually in her small intestine, there were cherries, grapes, and pineapple, which is a common fruit cocktail ingredients, those three ingredients. So here's what I think happened. I think Alice is right. I think John Bidet was at the White's house at the party, and the party's going on, and John Bidet may be wandering around. She may be in the kitchen, and some kind adult might have been, hey, are you hungry, little girl? And there's a, you know, a tin of fruit cocktail or one of those little plastic fruit cocktail cups, and they just opened it up and gave it to her, and she ate it. And her parents never knew, and the Whites never knew, and she ate the fruit cocktail. And then, you know, 2-3 hours later, she's murdered. And that's the solution to this big mystery. To me, that seems much more likely than this, the bowl and the pineapple thing. And if I had to guess about the bowl and the pineapple, I think the victim's advocates made it. I think the victim's advocates found out that Burke was coming back. Remember, they took Burke away, and he's coming back. And they thought, well, what's his favorite snack? They found out that it was his pineapple and milk, and they made it. And just no one remembers. No one ever put two and two together, or no one ever admitted it, or no one's ever been asked. I mean, there's all sorts of things that could have happened here. I think the bowl with the pineapple and the milk is a red herring.
Yeah, I think it is a red herring, too, because it's easy to kind of zone in on one thing, kind of like you said, the fact that it wasn't just the pineapple in JonBenet's stomach, right? There were other fruits. And when you put all those fruits together, then you're like, oh, right, a fruit cocktail. I'm thinking of one of those kid cups, like mm-hmm. you peel off the top and it's all like in sugary water. And I wouldn't, even if I had that in my pantry, I might have it in my pantry. I don't think I do, but who knows? I had like a kid birthday party recently. I bought a bunch of stuff we don't normally eat, and things are always tucked into my pantry for those kind of parties that I don't usually feed my children. And I wouldn't, if you're asking me what I served at a party, if it was today, I would certainly not say anything with fruit cocktail, because I would not have thought of that little cup in the back of my pantry that's not actually intended to be served, right?
And let me just also say that the 90s were a fruit cocktail time. People were eating fruit cocktail in the 90s. Probably the last time I had fruit cocktail was in the 90s. I used to eat fruit cocktail in the 80s and 90s all the time. I don't know that anybody eats it anymore. So I think the chances that they had fruit cocktail at their house somewhere are really high, and it's exactly the kind of thing that a kid would eat as a snack.
Yes. And probably may not be allowed to eat because it's too sugary or something, you know? And so they like sneak away and eat it. At least my kids would.
You know, it's interesting. I think this pineapple thing could be a pretty big deal. People focus on this a lot, particularly the ones who think that Burke's involved. The pineapple has always been the motivation for a lot of people who think Burke did this. So if you take the pineapple away, all of a sudden there's a big hole in that theory. And I think that's one reason you'll see people push back on this pretty forcefully. There are people who will even deny this notion that fruit cocktail was found in her stomach. Most people who do that will point to the autopsy. The autopsy only lists pineapple. And I think there's a pretty good reason for that. During the autopsy, they collected JonBenet's stomach contents, as they do in those circumstances. Now, the person performing the autopsy obviously could see this pineapple material, but I guess the other material wasn't as readily available, or at least as readily detectable. And so eventually, and it took a couple months, the police sent these stomach contents off for further evaluation. And it was during this evaluation, I believe at the University of Colorado, that these stomach contents were found. That doesn't stop people from, like I said, sort of denying it's even true. I feel pretty confident it is true. If there's somebody who has a knockdown argument against the fruit cocktail, I'd like to hear it. But to me, I think it's pretty definitive that she had fruit cocktail in her stomach. So it seems as though the pineapple in the kitchen is unrelated. If she, say, ate both, you would see the fruit cocktail at sort of one point in her digestive system. And then at some further back point, you would see the pineapple from the kitchen. And you don't see that. So to me, this seems like a rock solid fact about the fruit cocktail. And I think you just have to deal with that if your theory involves Burke or someone else in the house doing this and it's related to this pineapple in the kitchen.
Another thing that's very interesting to discuss is what did the family actually do the night before JonBenet Ramsey was found dead? One of the strange things about this case that has brought some suspicion on the Ramseys is the details of what happened the night before. The standard Ramsey account has been that JonBenet was asleep when they arrived back from the Christmas party they had attended. John carried JonBenet into her room where Patsy changed her clothes and she went to sleep. John then helped Burke with a toy before he went to sleep as well, followed by the rest of the family. But according to John's initial statements to Officer French, he read to both children that night. Burke would later say that JonBenet was awake when they got home and walked in front of him on the way up the steps. Now, these may seem like minor things, but it seems at least somewhat strange that there's no single consistent story about what happened the night before. And that's a pretty big thing, right? Whether she is asleep or not. Because if she is asleep, she cannot be walking by herself. You had to carry her in. And if she is awake, there's just kids usually are hyped up from a party. It's Christmas. There's probably at least some commotion and some level of winding down before going to bed if they are awake. And you would think you'd remember that, especially because of the fun festivities of the day.
Look, John's obviously under a lot of stress at this time when he's giving this initial statement to Officer French. He later will say that what he meant is that he read after the kids went to sleep, before he went to sleep with the melatonin. It's also possible that Officer French just misheard him and wrote that down wrong. That happens. I mean, we see that in police reports, not all the time, but it happens that slight mistakes will be made in the police report, particularly when someone's telling you a story. And so, you know, I put the kids to bed and then read gets transposed into I read to the kids in bed, right? Or something along those lines. So that's a possibility. But yes, it does seem strange to me that, number one, it seems strange to me that everybody's so adamant that JonBenet was asleep, and maybe that's just because she was, and that's what they remember, and you would remember it, and they do remember it, and so that's what they say. But you know how it is. I mean, you get your kids home, they're kind of asleep in the back of the car, but then they wake up when you pick them up, and maybe she did walk up the stairs into the house, but really was basically asleep, and then they carried her up and put her in bed. I mean, who knows? And this may seem small, and it may not be important, but the reason it is because people who think the parents are involved think the entire story of that night after they get home from the Whites is a fabrication. That, you know, maybe JonBenet never went to bed, just like Patsy never went to bed. And the murder might have happened quickly afterwards. And, you know, maybe the first thing Patsy did was she made that bowl of pineapple, right? I mean, you can imagine this is how the story goes. They're both awake, she makes a pineapple, and then the event happens, right? I mean, I don't know. That's a possibility. These are minor inconsistencies, but they are inconsistencies. And I don't think you can ignore them. But the fact remains that the story the parents have told since that day, since that statement to French, has been that JonBenet is asleep, was asleep at the time. You know, is it weird that Burke remembers something slightly different? Maybe, maybe not. He was 9 at the time. This was told several days later, maybe even weeks later, when he talks about this. So who knows if he remembers it correctly or not. I can remember when my daughter went to bed last night. I couldn't tell you. If you asked me a week ago what was her bedtime routine, I would not be able to tell you. So who knows? But it's something that people talk about, so it's something we wanted to point out.
And Brett, you just made a really good point in there that I don't think a lot of people understand. A police report is not a statement by a witness. So the police report about what John said is not John's statement because he doesn't swear to it. He doesn't sign it. He doesn't review it for accuracy once it's written up. Rather, it's the statement of the police officer who wrote it. And that's really important to know. And that's why he's not necessarily lying if he thinks he told Officer French his story now and Officer French miswrote it. Just because the police report exists, it's actually not John's testimony. It is the testimony. It's the testimony. It's the report of Officer French. So keep that distinction in mind as well.
Yeah, and it's an important distinction. And police officers, the reports of police officers are not admissible in court for a lot of different reasons. The police officer has to testify. What the police officer can do is use the report to refresh his own memory. So he can look at that report. You know, if you ask him, what did John Ramsey tell you about his daughter? And he's like, I don't remember. You can say, would it help to review your report? Yes. Here's a report. They read it. Is your, you know, recollection refreshed? Yes, it is. And you take back the report, and then they say, he told me that he read to her that night, right? So the police reports are important. We always talk about them because they are contemporaneous accounts that the police are recording. You would hope they would be accurate, but they're not. They're certainly not foolproof, and they're certainly not gospel. And the best you can do is sort of look at them. They are, I'll tell you when they're important, is when the police write something down. You know, I observed the door open. And then 2 weeks later, they're like, I'm going to amend my report to say the door was closed. Something like that happens. That is fishy. So, and we actually see some of that in this case. And several of their police reports, you know, I think Detective Arndt took a while to finish her report. This is something that Thomas talks about in his book, about how frustrating it was that so many police officers who were on the scene at the time did not complete their reports. One of the things that's funny about Thomas's book is he is so adamant that Patsy Ramsey did it, but half of his book is complaining about how inept the police were the day of and how, you know, they couldn't even rule out whether certain officers were in certain rooms because it was such an inept investigation. It always blows my mind that he can be so certain about what happened when he admits that the evidence itself is really compromised. But in any event, so we talked about this flashlight earlier. There was a heavy-duty Maglite-style flashlight in the kitchen. And this flashlight is sometimes pointed to as evidence of an intruder because the Ramseys would say that they did not own a flashlight like this. Now, that is disputed. There are people who claim that they did own that flashlight, but in any event, they say they didn't. The flashlight was dusted for prints. There were none on the flashlight or on the batteries. This is another one of those things that some people think is interesting or potentially damning for somebody. But, you know, which way does it really cut? As we've said before, just because there are no fingerprints on something doesn't mean it's wiped down, especially on something you barely touch like the batteries. And flashlights, because of the way they're made, the texture of the flashlight actually makes it more difficult to get a fingerprint off of it. The batteries, really, you should be able to get a pretty good fingerprint, but once again, you're not touching them for very long. It's actually a good thing to dust the batteries because that is something that people don't often think of wiping down. Now, having said all that, it does seem strange there are no fingerprints on this flashlight. This has led some people to believe that Burke, after he struck JBR with this flashlight, that somebody wiped it down. Couple problems with that. First, if it's the murder weapon, why not get rid of it? This is a pretty important piece of evidence here. There are other items that we know were used in the crime that were either brought by the killer or disposed of by the Ramseys because we don't see them there and we don't see the source for these items. So you'd think if, for instance, you're getting rid of the cord and the duct tape, that you would get rid of the flashlight too if you knew the flashlight was the murder weapon. Now, it's possible you just forgot, you overlooked it, you didn't think about getting rid of it, and you accidentally left in the kitchen. But then you would assume that you would also forget to wipe down the murder weapon. If you forgot to dispose of it, why would you remember to wipe it down? And if you remembered to wipe it down, going so far as to wipe down the batteries themselves, you would think that you would go ahead and get rid of that flashlight. Also, wiping down the batteries is something that is that makes almost no sense and would take an uncannily thoughtful duo of parents reeling from the murder of their little girl under this theory by their son to think, well, let's wipe down the battery so nobody connects this flashlight to us, but then we're going to forget to get rid of it, right? That just seems like a crazy thing that you would do both of those. An intruder, however, might have forgotten the flashlight in the heat of the moment. It's probably in the kitchen where this ransom note was written. Maybe if they did make the bowl of pineapple, they're in the kitchen for a while. Who knows? They could have forgotten the flashlight. And while it would seem strange for the parents to wipe down the batteries, to think of that while covering up the crime of their son, it actually seems like something you would think of if you've meticulously planned this murder and obsessed over it to the point that you've memorized lines from movies that you're going to put in the ransom note. That does seem like something you would do, wipe down the batteries. The biggest problem here, though, is that if the flashlight were the murder weapon, you would expect it would have left a cut on JonBenet's head. It's hard to believe that if you whack somebody in the head with a flashlight, they wouldn't bleed. I don't know exactly how this wound was made, but that seems like the kind of thing that would cut open your forehead. That seems like the kind of thing that would cause blood, and we just don't see that here. And perhaps more importantly, if you're going to strike somebody hard enough to shatter their skull with a flashlight, you would expect there would be some damage on this flashlight. You would expect it'd be pretty obvious that it was the flashlight that was the murder weapon. You would not expect to find it in pristine condition. And I know there are people who've done tests about whether or not a child striking a skull with a flashlight could cause this damage. There are people who claim that it would. The CBS documentary includes this sort of depiction, which I'm sure there's no telling how many times they they recreated this before they finally got what they wanted. But even assume it can, I don't think you could strike somebody in the head with a flashlight to the point of shattering their skull, causing a crack that ran all the way down their skull, breaking open a massive piece of their skull, and not leaving any damage to the flashlight. I just don't think that's possible.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to agree with you there, because here's the thing. Not only would I think there would be some sort of damage to the flashlight, but I think it would have struck with such force that there would be some almost like microscopic type of cracking or something where DNA could be stuck into the mag light flashlight, that where you even wipe it down because it's not smooth anymore because of the impact, there'd be bits of DNA that you couldn't get out just by wiping it without, say, dipping it in bleach or something. And it just seems hard to believe that that type of force would be used with a flashlight, cause no damage to the flashlight, and cause no residue DNA from JonBenet to be on the flashlight.
And I'll just tell you where I think the flashlight came from. I think the flashlight is one of the police officer's flashlights.
I know. It's exactly what you carry as a police officer. It really is. In fact, I have a friend who maybe we'll hear from sometime on this podcast, has spent time as a beat cop. And when we were all entering pandemic mode and everyone was kind of in Armageddon mindset, at least I was, like, what should I get to make sure, you know, we have everything in case we don't have food, in case we don't have electricity. And he told me to get this type of a flashlight. He's like, get these types of flashlights because they can be security. If someone's coming to your home, you know, you can shine it in that direction. It scares them because it looks like a spotlight. They're heavy duty. They can withstand a lot of kind of trauma. They can withstand a car accident if you have one. And he, as a police officer, said, I carry this. You should get one for your house, like for protection.
And based on the behavior of the police in this case, and we're going to see more instances of this, if a cop left the flashlight behind, they probably would not have admitted it, because that was just the way they rolled in this case. And Don't forget, most police officers, especially beat cops, or a lot of them, maybe not most of them, but a lot of them wear gloves a lot of the time. So it wouldn't be surprising that one of their flashlights would not have fingerprints on it because they're often holding it with gloves. And even if they replaced the batteries, they might have been wearing gloves. So to me, the most obvious answer here is just, this is a yet another example of the police just leaving something and contaminating the crime scene that has become something people have focused on. Before we go on, I want to introduce the newest sponsor of our podcast, Stamps.com. You know, Alice, we got a little podcast going here, and there might be some people who are listening to us who think it's not that big a deal, but I can tell you it is a lot of work. And I know there are so many people out there who have small businesses, who have side jobs, who are selling stuff on Etsy, and it is a big deal to you, and your time is precious. You can't afford to miss out on opportunities to grow and keep your customers wanting more.
Absolutely, Brett. And that's why with Stamps.com, you can skip a trip to the post office and focus on how to take your small business to the next level. Stamps.com lets you print official postage right from your computer and saves you money in the process. So you can spend less time at the post office and more time making your customers happy. Stamps.com, for more than 20 years, has been indispensable for over 1 million businesses. Stamps.com gives you access to all the post office and UPS shipping services you need right from your computer. And get discounts you can't find anywhere else, like up to 40% off USPS rates and 76% off UPS. We can all stand to save a little money right now.
So save yourself some precious time and stop overpaying for shipping with Stamps.com. Sign up with promo code PROSECUTE for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial, free postage, and a digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to stamps.com, click the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code PROSECUTE. That's stamps.com, code PROSECUTE.
Another interesting point of discussion is just how many people had keys to the Ramsey house. In his initial statement to Officer French, John Ramsey would say that the only people who had keys to the house were relatives in Atlanta and the housekeeper. But that number would quickly balloon into upwards of 30 or 40 keys floating around. Moreover, later reports would say that a key in hideaway near the front of the house was also missing. So, for all you out there, security purposes, it's really common, I know, for people to hide keys outside of their homes. Don't do it. That is the first place an intruder looks, is somewhere outside. You're not being sneaky if you hide it under a chair or under a flower pot or in a fake rock that slides out with a secret compartment that you place near your front door. It's just really hard to hide a key in a place that can be easily identifiable that an intruder wouldn't know to look. So if you have a key outside, sure, an intruder can look for it and use it to enter your home at that moment, or they can take it and make copies of it so you never know that the key is missing later on and use the key at a later time. So that's the first thing on a hideaway key. So generally, don't do it. If you have to, give your keys to, you know, a trusted friend who lives within driving distance for if you lock yourself out. And the other thing is, now this is strange, right? John is saying only the housekeeper and family in Atlanta have the key to our house. Then, of course, later that number goes to not just a few more people, but we're talking dozens more keys out there. Brett, what do you think about this? Do dozens of people have keys to your house?
I mean, dozens of people don't, but I'm also not somebody who's wealthy, who has like all sorts of people working on the house. The other thing about their home, this is, you know, they were on the parade of homes. This is a home that they used as a showcase. There were people in and out of that house. I think probably John just wasn't thinking. I think he, you know, he thought of the people who had keys that readily jumped to his mind at the time. And then after further consideration, it just became clear that there were all sorts of keys to this house. They were all over the place. You know, I think you're the only person who has a key to my house other than me. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't strike me as that strange, I guess. Like, I mean, it's strange. It's not normal by any stretch of the imagination.
No, no, no. I think I'll back you up there. I think I agree with you, especially with a home of this size and yard work. You have a lot of people coming in. This actually brings to mind something today. So I have an electronic keypad with a code. And I had people who had to come work on my air conditioning today. Yes, it's winter, and we had like a heat. I just realized somehow that our AC didn't work, and I was going to be out of the house. And so I gave the code to the AC guy, who I know, who's come a few times, so I trusted him to give the code to. But in my mind, I was like, I'm going to change the code when I get home. And guess what? It's now been like 12 hours later. And as we're recording this episode, I'm remembering that I should go change the code, and I still haven't done it, right? And that's like an electronic key, but that's something, if you asked me tomorrow or the next day or next week, who knows the code to my house, I'm probably just going to tell you my family. But in reality, actually, I think my yard guy knows it, and so does now the HVAC guy. And I keep meaning to change it, but I haven't. So I can understand kind of forgetting who you've given the keys to, especially if it's for a one-time sort of deal, like coming to work on the bathroom, a plumber or something, and they're busy, they're jet setting. They quite literally are jet setting because they have a plane. I could see them giving keys to the people who help keep their house running for all the times that they are not at home.
Yeah, and why is this important? Probably the chief reason that a lot of people think the Ramseys are involved is the notion that it couldn't have been an outsider, that there's no way an outsider could have gotten in. We're going to talk later about this broken window and the, you know, barrels of ink that have been spilled about whether or not an intruder could have gotten in that window without disturbing a spider web that was close to it. And at the end of the day, it might not matter. The window might just be broken and have nothing to do with this case because there were so many keys available, and it seems like there were multiple ways to enter this home. And for all we know, the killer walked in through the front door with a key they found in the hideaway and then walked out the front door and locked it behind them. That, for all we know, that's what happened. And, you know, that is really important because it takes away this massive clue over whether or not the Ramseys are involved. Think back to the Darla Routier case. And we talked about how, you know, the police, when they looked at her house, they went around and they looked to see whether or not there was any evidence of an intruder standing in front of the windows, trying the sliding glass door. And they really didn't find anything. And there was just this one window that had been cut open. And that was really the only sign of anybody there. And there wasn't really that much disturbance going in or out of that window. And it just made you think, this is a setup, nobody actually came through here. Well, it's the same thing here. We're trying to see whether or not, by looking at the exterior of the house and the obvious entry point, which is this broken window, if we can rule that out and say nobody came through there, does that mean the Ramseys did it? Or at least there's a strong possibility they did. But if in reality there were all sorts of other people who could have gotten into that house other ways, then that piece of evidence just becomes so much weaker than people have made it out to be. Okay, let's talk about the marks on JonBenet Ramsey herself. So we've posted links to these. If you look on acandyrose.com, there are multiple crime scene photos, there are autopsy photos that show these two similar, I mean, basically the same size marks that are on JonBenet's skin. There's one, really two, sort of behind her ear. And then there are another two that are on her back. And they really kind of look like burn marks. They look like cigarette burns is what they look like to me. You know, if you took a cigarette and you burned somebody, this very small burn mark, circular burn mark, and you have these that are the same size that are, you know, about an inch apart or so. If you look at the photos, you can see them. And everybody who had seen JonBenet up to that point, particularly the ones on her face, and they wouldn't have seen the ones on her back so much, but the ones on her face say she did not have those the night she was killed. So where did they come from? Well, the people who think this is an intruder think that they are marks from a stun gun. Now, stun guns are known in certain circumstances to leave what are called cutaneous current marks upon impact with the skin. Now, if you look at these marks, they are roughly 3.5 centimeters apart. Some of the officers who looked at this, including Lou Smith, who we're going to talk about more, claimed that this was about the distance between the two prongs on an Air Taser 34,000. People dispute this sometimes. They say it's a little bit more or it's a little bit less. I don't know how much that matters. You know, no two things created even in a factory are going to be exactly the same. So if it's pretty close is probably close enough. Now, there are other examples of these that we know come from stun guns. We've also put those, or we've linked to some pictures of those online as well. And you can see they look very similar. Not maybe exactly the same, but pretty similar to the marks you see on JonBenet. And we know that J.C. Dugard, who was kidnapped in 1991, her kidnapper used a stun gun on her. And she has said that once the stun gun was used on her, she was unable to scream or move, and that essentially the stun gun rendered her unconscious. And the theory is that the stun gun would explain the lack of any evidence of an initial struggle by JonBenet. Remember, whatever happened in that basement, whether you could hear that or not in the main house, before that happened, you would have had JonBenet in her bedroom. Whoever did this, it started in the bedroom. And if JonBenet's screaming in her bedroom, you would expect someone would hear that. But nobody heard anything. So the theory is the person comes in, they stun her, they then take her down to the basement, and the rest happens. And this explains those marks, and it also explains the lack of any screaming. Those who favor the theory that Burke Ramsey killed his sister believe the marks were left by train tracks from his toy train set. The set was in a room downstairs near the room where JonBenet's body was found, and the marks are roughly consistent with the prongs of the middle track from the set. So another sort of very close enough for, you know, probably government work here, close enough that they could have caused these in the same way that the stun gun is pretty close as well. The argument for this has been pretty thoroughly refuted. If you read the documents we talked about, the defamation suit in this case, there's a lot of discussion about this and about how the train tracks don't work. As an aside, it's interesting. Burke's attorney was Lynn Wood, who you've probably heard of. He's an interesting character. He famously represented Richard Jewell in his defamation case. And most recently, he was representing Donald Trump in his challenges to the 2020 election. So your opinions of him may vary, but in any event, we have that document. You can take a look at what he says about the train track thing. To me, the train track thing doesn't really fit. If you look at these wounds, they don't look like that kind of injury to me. I'm not sure what they look like. I don't know if they look similar to the burn marks in the stun gun, though not perfect. But I don't know. It's an interesting theory. It was a theory favored by Lou Smith, who was a police officer who at one time worked for Boulder, but then eventually worked for the parents as part of the defense team. He really liked this theory. A lot of people hate this theory. You know, Thomas, in his book, really hates this theory. Now, the thing that irritates me about Thomas a lot of times is if you read his book, whenever the stun gun comes up, he just says it wasn't a stun gun. He just asserts it. Right? Or he quotes another officer when Lou Smith says, maybe it was a stun gun. The officer's like, it wasn't an effing stun gun. I mean, the number of times he says that in the book, I don't know. But he never explains why it wasn't. Like, he never gives any kind of refutation of the stun gun theory. And he does that a lot, where he just sort of asserts things, but never really explains them, which is a problem for an investigator. And we're going to point to other times he does that, which I don't really get. But a lot of people think this is a theory that's been refuted. I don't know that it has been refuted, but the marks came from somewhere, and it probably had something to do with whatever happened to JonBenet. Personally, I like stun gun theory better than train tracks, but doesn't mean that either one of them necessarily caused these injuries.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that the train track theory has been pretty well refuted, because it doesn't make sense, right? It doesn't fit in with the other theory of why Burke would have done it, which is the pineapple and the flashlight. Because what, you deliver a fatal blow to your sister's head. And then when your parents are doing the cover up, or maybe you're doing the cover up in the basement, so you've dragged her now, you know, unmoving body down to the basement next to your favorite train tracks, then you're going to stop and she's already unconscious. What's like, bang her with your train tracks out of continued anger? It makes no sense in terms of if you have to think about the whole theory of what happened with those train tracks.
The only thing I've read from people on this is that he's like, he bashed her in the head for some reason. You would think in the kitchen around the pineapple, but maybe not. Maybe he whacked her in the head downstairs for some reason, and then somehow the flashlight ended upstairs, or maybe it wasn't the flashlight, who knows. And then he's like poking her with the train tracks to try and wake her up, but that doesn't really make any sense either. I don't know why he'd poke her with train tracks.
And that wouldn't leave a mark, right? I mean, my boys play with train tracks every day. I spent all day today playing train tracks with my boys. And we have wood ones. We have metal, not metal ones, but like really thick plastic ones. The ones that like Thomas the Train's on. The ones that clip together. We have every type of train track there are. And let me tell you, my kids beat the crap out of each other with every toy, including train tracks. And they are chucking these like heavy duty solid wood train tracks at each other. And I like heard a crack and I thought someone's, you know, I really thought someone's bone had broken. Not a mark, right? Like literally not a mark on anyone. So it would be very surprising to me that a simple poke, like wake up, sister, would leave a mark that could be seen hours after death.
No, I agree 100%. I think the train track theory is, I think it's silly. I'm happy to listen to people if you have strong feelings on the train track and you can explain it a little bit better to me than what I've been able to find. I'd love to hear a more thorough explanation of the train track theory.
Brett, before we move on, I'm proud to say that the Prosecutors Podcast is brought to you by Progressive. What's one thing you'd purchase with a little extra savings? A weighted blanket, smart speaker, that new self-care trend you keep hearing about? Well, Progressive wants to make sure you're getting what you want by helping you save money on car insurance.
Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save over $700 on average, and customers can qualify for an average of 6 discounts when they sign up. Discounts like having multiple vehicles on your policy. Progressive offers outstanding coverage and award-winning claim service. Day or night, they have customer support 24/7, 365 days a year. When you need them most, they're at their best.
A little off your rate each month goes a long way. Get a quote today at progressive.com and see why 4 out of 5 new auto customers recommend Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National annual average insurance savings by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2020 and May 2021. Potential savings will vary. Discounts vary and are not available in all states and situations.
Okay, so we've talked about some weird things about this case. Let's talk about the evidence against the Ramseys. So what is the evidence against the Ramseys? And then we'll talk about evidence for an intruder, sort of for and against here, just trying to see what are the things that point one way or the other. And I think one thing a lot of people point to is the finding of JonBenet's body. So shockingly, but not surprisingly, given everything we know about the police in this case, after Fleet White and his wife arrive at around 6 a.m., he is allowed to conduct a search on his own of the house. So he goes around the house, he goes downstairs into the basement, he looks in the room with the broken window and the suitcase. He moves the suitcase at one point. This is the room that the killer may or may not have come in through. And then he looks into this quote-unquote wine cellar. Now, it's dark inside, and he can't see anything, and he can't find the light switch, which apparently was in kind of a weird place where you would only know it was there if you knew it was there. So he doesn't take too much time down there. He closes the door. He goes back upstairs. So then at around 1, you have Linda Arndt, who's trying to get John to calm down because he's obviously very nervous and she wants to occupy his mind. And so she thinks it's a good idea for him to look for clues. Is there anything out of the ordinary? He's not looking for JonBenet or her body. He's just supposed to be looking for anything that might stand out to him that could help the police in their investigation. When this is often described by people who were describing how this happened, they will say that Linda Arndt said do a top-to-bottom search of the house and that John immediately went directly downstairs and went straight to the wine cellar, opened up the door, and despite the darkness, which we know you couldn't see into, cries out that he's found JonBenet's body. And this is pointed to by a lot of people as evidence that John knew the body was there, and he was ready for the body to be found so they could move on with this. The problem is that story is not true. That is not what happened. According to both White and John, the first room that they go into was the train room, the room with the broken window. So they're told to search the place. They go downstairs. They're going to start with the basement. They go into this train room with a broken window. This is the same room that White went into first when he initially searched the basement, and this makes sense. If you look at a map of the basement, although people have described it as maze-like, when you come down the stairs, it actually makes sense that you'd either go in the train room or into the area of the storage room, the room where the wine cellar is. The train room door is to your right, and then the door to the hallway leading to the storage room is on your left.
Now, after searching the train room, the two men then searched a shower stall in the basement. They then noticed a fireplace grate propped in front of a closet. After moving it, they searched that closet but found nothing. They then went to the wine cellar. According to John's earliest accounts, he opened the door, flipped on the light switch, and saw his daughter. Most of the accounts that seek to show that John either killed his daughter or was helping his wife cover it up simply leave out the part where he flipped on the light, leading to extensive arguments about whether John would have been able to see his daughter's body in the darkened room. I do have to note, though, that multiple people had opened this door and couldn't find the light switch, but the killer whoever put JonBenet's body in that room likely had to find a light switch or likely had to use some light, whether it be a flashlight or some other way, maybe the hall light, because it would probably be difficult to, for example, place her down and cover her with a blanket if it were in complete darkness, especially if you didn't know what was in that room. So that can factor into our theories later, but I think that's important to note that if you're completely unfamiliar with this room, you may be stumbling around in complete darkness, which may make your work hard to do if you are the murderer. It has also been repeated ad nauseum that Fleet White said John cried out before turning on the light. First, if this is true, we were not able to find a primary source for it. We can't find Fleet White saying this anywhere. Second, in the Judge Carnes opinion that we've talked about, the sequence of events as John described it is considered undisputed, and the opinion cites his statements of fact for all the parties and to the White deposition. Moreover, those who have read the White deposition claim it was exceedingly favorable to the Ramseys. It's hard to believe that would be the case if he said that John found the body before turning on the light. Finally, even if it is true, it's a weird thing for White to even know. This would have been a bang-bang thing. There's a door opening, a scream, and a light going on, all of which would happen in very quick succession, especially if White didn't know what was going to be found behind that door. For White to be able to now say that John screamed in the split second before the light went on and not the split second after is very difficult to say. It seems improbable.
Yeah, I think this is another one of those things that people, when they're talking about the case, you know, there's so much question begging in true crime. And, you know, question begging, when you say it begs a question, a lot of people use it, quote unquote, incorrectly. I actually like the colloquial, it begs a question. It actually fits a nice little niche in our language. You know, it begs the question, did he know? That's actually fine. So, you know, quit being losers about that. People who want to complain about that. But nevertheless, question begging is a logical fallacy. And it means you're assuming one of the premises of your argument in order to make the argument. So what people often do is they just assume that it is fact that John saw JonBenet's body in the darkness before he turned on the light. That's just a fact. It's undisputed. Everybody knows that's true. So given that that's a fact, how is it possible that he saw her body? And in reality, we don't know that. In reality, we have at best some speculation that that might have been the case, possibly that Fleet White at some point said that that was the case, but then contradictory testimony by him. We have not seen the White deposition. It was, I guess, public for a little while, despite a court order that it shouldn't be, which then resulted in a court order that it be taken off the internet where it was. Maybe it's still out there. I don't like violating court orders, so I didn't really look for it that hard. But in any event, it seems as though in his deposition, he does not say definitively that John saw the body before he turned the light on. So, given that fact, it really would not be that surprising if John opens that door, knows where the light switch is, immediately turns it on, and then sees the body. I mean, that's just not that strange thing. Doesn't mean that he didn't know the body was going to be there. Doesn't mean he didn't go down there to find it, but the sort of standard narrative that is often given to you is probably incorrect. There's a couple other things that are interesting about this. John finds the body. That is not what you would expect. Normally, and you know, these behavioral analysis things are always caveated. Normally, people who are involved in these kind of crimes set up someone else to find the body. So think back to the Lizzie Borden case and how Lizzie Borden, after she finds her father's body, which she basically had to find him, there was no getting around that, will not go upstairs to where her stepmother's body is. Instead, she sends someone else to go up there to look, and of course, they find the body. And this is a pretty common thing. So what you would expect to happen here would be John to say something like, "Hey, go check the wine cellar. I'll go in the train room." And then he sends Fleet White in there and he finds the body. In this case, you have John finding the body, which is a little bit out of line with what you would normally expect. Once again, there are exceptions to every rule, so that's not definitive, but it's not maybe the most common thing that you would see from someone who had killed someone and then set up the body to be found.
Yeah, we often see, even if there is a killer who wants their crime, we've talked about how killers may go back to the scene of the crime to participate in the search of a missing person or to kind of see their crime, their masterpiece unfold. Even in those instances, they try to drop hints to other people so that the crime can be solved sooner, the body can be found. Like, have we looked under the bridge? Have we looked? She loved playing hide and seek in the basement, you know, those sorts of things, so that they are not the ones to actually find it, because what they rejoice in is actually someone else discovering their handiwork, if that makes sense.
I think this really serves to illustrate the nuances of behavioral analysis. And while it's not the sort of slam dunk science that we all want it to be, we want it to be the case that you can say definitively, well, John found the body, and we all know that it's always staged, that someone else will find the body, so it must not have been him, and it's just not that simple. As we've said before, there are circumstances in which the person who finds the body is going to be the chief suspect. So if you're out, you know, on a search party looking for somebody who's missing and you find the body, you can guarantee you are going to be the police first suspect at least. They may quickly eliminate you, but there are some killers who that's part of their MO. They want to be the person who finds the body. They want to be at the center of it all. Then there are people like Alice said who would rather set it up for someone else to find the body so they can sort of revel in that. Now, one thing I will say is in these family context, typically I think the literature supports that family members tend to have someone else find the body. They tend to set it up so they are not the ones who find the body. I think this makes sense from a psychological point of view. As we've said, oftentimes when family members kill, it's driven not by some sort of psychopathy or cold-bloodedness, but some sort of passion or rage or something along those lines. And so they don't necessarily hate the person they killed. They don't hate their children. They're not necessarily happy that they're dead, particularly after it happened. So they may not want to be the person who finds it. Now, like we said, is it definitive? Just because John found the body means he couldn't have been involved in JonBenet's murder? No, it's not, but it is one of those things that you can consider when you're thinking about this whole case, big picture. And this is particularly true, and if you read some of John Douglas's books, who John's involved in this case, but he has some great books where he talks about this, and particularly in cases, the parents want the body to be found, right? I mean, most parents who kill their kids, it's not a cold-blooded thing. It happens for whatever reason, but the parents still bizarrely love their kids. And that's why you see things like, you know, them being found with their favorite teddy bear wrapped in their favorite blanket or something like that. So the parents want the body to be found. So they're going to make sure it's found. They don't want the body to be out in the elements. They don't want it to take too long. And so they will often direct the police to the body. And it's actually, it's a really good tactic that investigators, the FBI and other investigators will use a lot when they believe that parents have staged a kidnapping. So what you'll see sometimes is the parents will kill a child, and then in order to cover it up, they'll stage a kidnapping. And the fact that the body is out there somewhere, it really eats at them. And investigators are really able to use that to get them to admit where the body is and to take them to the body just by pointing out the fact that the body's out there and, you know, there might be animals out there, whatever. I mean, just not the kind of things you want to think about when you think about your kids. And as weird as it may seem to those of us who could never imagine harming our children, even parents who do harm their children, after they do it, often the guilt and the regret is so strong that they will succumb to those kind of tactics and lead the police to wherever the body is. That actually happens a good bit. So whatever the case, what we can all agree on and what we've talked about before and what we talked about at the beginning of today and where we're going to wrap up for today is that what happened next was a cascade of mistakes that probably destroyed any chance of solving the crime. So John sort of throws himself on his daughter. He rips the duct tape from her mouth. He loosens one of the bindings on her hand, which is interesting because Thomas in his book talks a lot about how the bindings didn't actually bind JonBenet because they were loose, but it's pretty clear from John's statement that he loosened the bindings on her hand, so I don't know how significant that is. But in any event, once it became clear that he'd need help to get her, you know, untied and everything else, he just grabs her up and carries her upstairs. Now, some people have commented on the manner that he carried her, which was sort of like out in front of him, so he didn't like, you know, he didn't cradle her or anything. He's kind of got her out in front of him. And some people have said that that's not a very personal way to carry her and that's not how a father would carry her or whatever. But the combination of her bound hands and the rope around her throat and everything else would have actually made it pretty difficult to carry her any other way. And he's trying to get her upstairs very quickly. So I don't know that he's thinking too much about the way he carries her when he just grabs her up and takes her upstairs. Also, rigor mortis is set in at this point, which is not something you like to talk about, but it's a fact, which also would have made it more difficult to carry her. Now, you can say, well, then wouldn't he have known she was dead? As we've said before, maybe, or maybe he's in denial, which is the most likely answer to that. Once he gets her upstairs, he's laying her on the carpet, which is all sorts of cross-contamination is going to happen then. Linda Arndt, for reasons that aren't clear, picks her up and carries her into another room, puts her next to a Christmas tree. She then gets covered up by that blanket. She gets covered up by the sweatshirt. At some point, Patsy's throwing herself on top of her daughter. All sorts of cross-contamination. We talk about later fibers that are found on her body, and did this fiber come from Patsy's coat? Probably, because Patsy was all over her body, so that wouldn't be that surprising. And this is just a huge problem, both the crime scene and the body. I mean, that's where you're going to get most of your evidence. If you're going to solve a murder, you're going to do it by things in the crime scene and things in the body. And both of those things have just been absolutely destroyed, either because through sort of no fault of his own, absolutely innocent reaction of a father, or because of some nefarious, John knows this is the best way to make sure that there is no evidence as to react in this way. It could be either one, but whatever it is, we have a huge problem. But that doesn't mean we're going to give up. We're going to keep looking at this case. We've got a lot more we want to talk about. Next week, we're going to listen to the 911 call in this case, let you guys listen to it and decide what you think about the call from Patsy and whether it incriminates her or not. We're going to talk about some of the reactions and behavior of the Ramseys, which, you know, a lot of people put a lot of stock into. Whether it's important or not, it's worth looking at. We're going to talk about weird things like the fact that Patsy was wearing the same outfit 2 days in a row, and is that the kind of thing that a self-conscious beauty queen would do? We'll talk about some fiber evidence and various other aspects of this case that we hope will be interesting to you. We'll also get into possible evidence of an intruder, whether or not there was prior sexual assault. There's just all sorts of things to talk about. Who knows whether we'll get finished next week. We're not going to rush through it, but I think we are at least closing in on the finish line. We can see the finish line somewhere in the distance.
Don't promise anything we can't deliver, Brett.
It's somewhere in the distance. I don't know how many episodes distant it is, but we're going to get there eventually, I promise you. But I think everything we've discussed is worth discussing, and I think it's worth the time we're taking on it. So once again, if you love this case, I assume you love this discussion. And if you hate this case, eventually it will be over and we'll move on to something else. But if you have things that you want to share with us or things you want to say, shoot us an email at prosecutorspod@gmail.com. Look us up at prosecutorspod on all your social media. Join the gallery on Facebook for a discussion there. Join our Patreon if you want to hear these episodes ad-free and often early. If you're on Patreon, you're probably hearing this a couple weeks early, as a matter of fact, because Alice and I are recording all this well ahead of time. But we're always interested in what you have to say. Thank you so much for all the support you've given us, all the emails you've sent us, all those five-star reviews, all the friends you've told. You will never know how much it means to us. By the time you hear this, who knows? Maybe our trial will be over, but I'm not going to make any promises there either.
One can hope, Brett. I feel like we are chipmunks hoarding acorns, like podcast episodes for the winter, like because we don't know what the future holds. So just so you guys know, we are like recording late into the night. We got some snarky messages during this holiday season about us not having new episodes. But just so you know, you guys didn't get new episodes around the Christmas holiday, but we've been recording like every single night. So yeah, we love Alice, you guys. Man.
She's cracking that whip on me, guys. Totally cracking the whip on me, which is fine. I appreciate it. But, well, that's all we have for today. We'll be back next week with more on JonBenet Ramsey. But until then, I'm Brett.
And I'm Alice.
And we are the prosecutors.
I hated the Patreon episodes. F you guys for taking time off.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay. Merry Christmas to you too.
I know, that was so strange.
Work during so Christmas, weird. Bitches.
Yeah, I don't know. People
are weird, man. I was like, thanks people for the five-star review question.
Yeah, it's like, I'll take the review. I mean, I just don't know why you feel the need to pop off like that.
Also, like, then don't listen to it. It's okay. I don't expect
you to listen.
You don't
have to listen to all the episodes.
I'm not going to lie. I didn't listen to it. I know what happens. I'm listening.
Yeah, exactly. I don't pretend to listen to those either.
Episode 5, man. Pressure is on. Is this going to be a 10-parter?
I don't know.
We go into it, though.
Yeah. We still haven't done, though, I guess. I don't know. We'll just see. Let's see how far we get to.